This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. There's been a lot of immigration news this week, from the Trump administration announcing that it will no longer accept DACA applications, to news that undocumented immigrants may be excluded from the census, will be excluded from the census. So here to catch us up on it all is WBUR Shannon Dooling. Welcome back, Shannon.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
So we have a lot to go through. Let's start with DACA. The administration has said it's not going to accept new DACA applications. What does this mean for people here in the Commonwealth?
Right, exactly. I mean, it means that for the time being, anyone who is trying to submit a new application, an initial application, following the Supreme Court's ruling is out of luck, again, for the time being. Earlier this week, the acting director of the Department of Homeland Security said the agency is rethinking through the future of the program. And in the meantime, they won't be processing any new applications. And they're also limiting the renewal period from 2 years down to 1 year.
Which means that there's an impact for people who are current DACA recipients, right?
Absolutely. So that renewal period will be a hit to those folks who are accustomed to, you know, having 2 years of guaranteed protection from deportation. You know, it's perhaps a sign of the administration's anticipated timing of the next effort that they're, you know, pulling through right now to dismantle the DACA program. It also means that current recipients will only have 1 year of guaranteed work authorization as well.
They also have to pay a substantial application fee every time, which means they have to pay that every year now instead of every other year, right?
Absolutely. A couple of hundred bucks. Yep.
All right. So let's put this in context. I mean, last month here on the show, we followed the Supreme Court decision about DACA. It blocked the efforts by the administration to end it, but on a procedural basis. So as you alluded to, is this how the administration is going forward in a continued attempt to roll back DACA? The court did say it could take another shot, essentially.
Yeah, it absolutely did. And I mean, I think most observers would say this is absolutely a continuation of that effort. We were expecting this from the administration, maybe not quite so rapidly, but we were expecting it. And the effort itself is within the president's executive authority. As you just mentioned, you'll remember that the Supreme Court decision didn't question Trump's ability to end the DACA program, but instead ruled that the manner in which he tried to do it originally was arbitrary and without, you know, any sound reason, and thus it was illegal. So Trump's immigration advisors are certainly looking for a way to avoid that pitfall this time around.
All right, so let's talk about the census. Later in the show, actually, we're going to have Secretary Bill Galvin on. The door-to-door census portion kicked off in the Commonwealth today. But four immigrants' rights groups are suing the administration now for a recent memo, I think that's the right word, that excludes undocumented immigrants from being counted in this year's census. They're saying that's unconstitutional and racist. Can the president do that?
Well, he says he can. the groups argue that the Constitution clearly states that all persons living in the country are to be counted, all persons, that the Constitution does not specify all citizens are to be counted. The president claims he has authority to further define what all persons means, and points to the fact that the Constitution does not specifically define who must be counted. So, I mean, really, this is going to come down to just a fascinating constitutional law case to watch play out, and one that has big implications for Massachusetts communities. The claim of racism on behalf of those organizations that have filed this lawsuit, and I should mention there are several of these lawsuits filed throughout the country, not just here in Massachusetts. But that's based largely on the fact that many of the undocumented immigrants living in the U.S., people who would in theory be ignored in the census per this memo are people of color. And we've seen time and time again from this administration a targeting of policies against these communities.
And so now this brings us, of course, back to the Supreme Court again. In their statement, the immigrants' rights group said, quote, undocumented immigrants are now and have always been persons as a matter of fact, law, and basic human decency. Nevertheless, the Trump administration has continued to weaponize the census, end quote. Last year, the court blocked the Trump administration from including a citizenship question on the census. Is this just another way to get at that?
It is. I mean, it feels like his administration, like the Trump administration, is kind of grasping at some sort of big efforts that they have lost at over the last few years. It's certainly another attempt at intimidating or disenfranchising immigrants in the hopes they won't respond to the census. The citizenship question certainly would have struck fear into the millions of undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. And this latest move is an attempt to pretend they don't exist and that they're not contributing to our economy and communities, which we know they do. So these are certainly parallel efforts.
So at the same time, I want to ask, we know that historically there have been concerns among undocumented immigrant populations about completing the census, fear of information being disclosed to government agencies like ICE. Is that still a concern?
It absolutely is. I mean, I think a lot of organizations are fighting an uphill battle to try to quell those fears. I spoke recently with Patricia Sobovaro, who's the executive director of Agencia Alpha, which is a Boston-based immigrant support organization. Let's hear what she has to say.
It's very important for our community, especially our communities of color, to understand that the census is just statistics. Information is not going to be shared with ICE or the IRS or any other agency of the U.S. government. So it is important for us to be counted because it truly, our future depends on it.
So Sobovaro says that at a time like this, when communities of color, especially in heavily immigrant communities, are suffering, particularly from the effects of the pandemic, we need to ensure that everyone is counted to ensure resources are allocated appropriately.
We need to make sure that our cities, our towns have enough resources to deal with these types of issues or pandemics. And by us not being counted, we lose out.
So explain that idea of losing out, Shannon.
Sure. So the state of Massachusetts and any other state with a significant number of undocumented immigrants could lose out on millions of dollars of federal funding for things like Head Start, the Children's Health Insurance Program, also known as CHIP. By one estimate, for every person not counted by the census, thousands of dollars a year that normally would go to that community needs, it just loses out on.
All right. So in our limited time, a couple other things I want to touch on. As part of the police reform debate on Beacon Hill, there was a re-energized push this month to get state legislators to grant driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants. The amendment to do this was withdrawn from the state house's police reform bill. So two questions at once there. Why was this advocated for in the context of police reform, and where does it go now?
Well, what we've been hearing a lot about in the context of police reform, the larger picture is, certainly that a lot of the ways that police currently operate are disproportionately having negative effects on communities of color, that some of the tactics are based in racism. And, there are certainly a tremendous amount of Black immigrants who are living in this community, in this country, and those communities, advocates say, need driver's licenses. That they point to the fact that a dramatic amount of the number of interactions that undocumented immigrants have with ICE come from the fact that they get pulled over from not driving with a license. And so it was tacked onto that police reform bill. There was also an effort to put it onto an economic bill, but that was also withdrawn. And, it doesn't appear to go anywhere from here. And speaking with some of the advocates who have led this for the last few years now, they feel really, I would say, betrayed is the word that they've used by the legislature. It's important to note, though, that Governor Baker all along has said that he would veto any legislation that granted driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants.
Okay. And in our last minute, just last night, a New York judge handed down an injunction. It blocked, at least temporarily, the public charge rule from taking effect during the COVID-19 pandemic. What was the argument and how does it affect people here in the Commonwealth?
Yeah, it's a pretty big victory for immigrant advocates and for healthcare professionals. The judge in this case said, look, anything that is deterring anyone from seeking healthcare in the midst of a pandemic, that's not going to work right now for the public health. So essentially the public charge rule was aimed at trying to, advocates would say it was aimed at trying to intimidate folks from seeking healthcare. And I think in theory, what advocates and healthcare professionals hope is that this means more people, regardless of their immigration status, will feel more secure in seeking treatment and testing for the coronavirus. which, you know, is especially crucial for immigrant communities, as many of these individuals are working on the front line as essential workers.
All right, so much going on. I'm sure we're going to keep watching it with you. That's WBUR Shannon Dooling. Thanks, Shannon.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Earlier today, President Trump tweeted this. With universal mail-in voting, not absentee voting, which is good, 2020 will be the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. It will be a great embarrassment to the USA. Delay the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote. Just in the last hour, we spoke with Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin, the public official here in the Commonwealth who's in charge of running our elections. And we began with his reaction to the president's call to delay the November election.
I mean, saying it's outrageous isn't enough, because everything he does is outrageous. But it is. It's bogus and deceitful, which he is, especially when it comes to elections. The election is not going to be delayed. The election is going to be on November 3rd. And people in many states, in every state really, are going to have the right to vote by mail if they need to. His attack on this makes no sense. His effort to distinguish the way he votes by mail, namely absentee, from early voting by mail is irrelevant. It's meaningless. It's the same process. He's not happy because he thinks it represents a political weakness on his part. So he's attempting to attack the process because he obviously there's no basis for doing so. So he says outrageous things. First of all, the election is in the United States Constitution. Everyone's familiar with the Electoral College. Surely he is. That's how he got elected. The Electoral College is spelled right out in the United States Constitution. The states and their electors must vote on a certain day in December. And it's this year. And it's going to happen. And we're going to have an election by the citizens on November 3rd. And many states like ours are going to have the opportunity to vote by mail because we have a pandemic going on and we don't want people to risk their health.
Let's stay there for a second, Secretary Galvin, because he is talking in part about Massachusetts. As you just said, should people be worried about the security of mail-in voting this year?
No, they shouldn't. Let me tell you why. First of all, we have a very established process here in terms of a system. Every voter who is registered as a voter in each city and town is entered into our central voter registration database, and that's the core of our system. The voters who receive the application to apply for an absent or a vote by mail application over the last few weeks might have noticed there was a barcode on it, which was their specific barcode. We're tracking the barcodes. We know who the voters are. We made sure that none of the mail was forwardable, so if people had moved, it was returned to us, and it has been. We also made very clear to people right over the signature line, and I insisted on this, that if there's any effort to illegally vote, and by anyone, not necessarily the person to whom it was addressed, it will be prosecuted, and it will. And I've had a record of prosecuting those individuals, mostly candidates, who have attempted to obfuscate the system or do something to the system and cheat, and some of them have gone to jail. So I assure you that's going to happen. We're working very closely with our local election officials, who are the people that actually administer this election. It's people in everybody's individual community who are going to administer it. We're working closely with them to verify the applications that come back. We will be aware of when people have voted by mail. They won't be able to vote again. In fact, in the mailing we sent out to people, we specifically said to them, once you voted, you have voted. That's it. We're also going to have vote in person. We're going to have it very safe. We're working hard to make sure the polling places are safe, they're socially distanced, they're clean, the voters aren't on top of each other. We're also going to have additional days of early voting in person. That will give people who don't particularly want to vote by mail, whether it's they haven't finally decided or whatever reason, the opportunity to vote, but not on the same day as everyone else by locations in their community. So with all these opportunities to vote, we'll certainly have the opportunity for everyone to participate.
This is going to be a massive process, this level of mail-in voting.
Yes, it is. We agree.
Do we have the capacity here in the Commonwealth to process everything in a timely way?
Well, we're making sure we do. We had a Zoom call today with all of our local clerks, the purpose of which is to understand what their capacities were. We are offering them, and we are looking to get the funds to make sure we have equipment so they can tabulate the ballots. They may need an additional clerical help. Some of those communities that don't have particularly large clerk's offices, we'll have to provide them with the funds to do that. I've also changed the law to allow persons as young as 16 to work in elections, provided they're trained. And we find that's an excellent work tool of younger people who are technologically savvy, who we can train to help with this process. We recognize the logistics are strong here, are tough, but they're certainly doable. We have large mailings all the time.
So every registered voter should have received an application for a ballot in the mail by now. There have been some reports that some haven't.
Unless they previously applied, or if they previously applied for an absentee this year instead of every ballot by mail, or if they had moved. If somebody moved, then obviously we would not have the current address and it will not be forwarded. So if they have moved and they didn't receive one. But there's a solution to that, too. They can go to my official website, and there's a form there they can print out and fill in. And they don't even need that. Any writing will do, provided that their signature is on, and obviously there has to be a registered voter.
I actually printed the form to look at it today, and it does. It takes about 25 seconds to fill it out.
Yeah.
I know you're in Western Massachusetts today and you're working on the census. There have been concerns about undercounting of vulnerable populations this time around.
I'm very concerned.
You're launching
about
the door-to-door portion. Yeah. So how is the door-to-door portion going, and how are you focused on making sure everyone gets counted?
Well, it's just starting today. Unfortunately, it's delayed because of COVID, and we're trying to make sure everyone gets counted. We're at a disadvantage. We're behind where we were at this point 10 years ago. About 65% of the households in Massachusetts have already responded to the census. That means 35% has not. Unfortunately, it's disproportionately in urban areas and poorer areas, and those are the people that we most need to count. We don't want to see our state get shortchanged. This is critically important. If we ever needed a reminder about the importance of federal assistance when it comes to health, we now have it. We need to make sure everyone's counted. We will get shortchanged unless we do. Yeah, it's important for people to know the information being solicited is strictly about numbers. It's how many people are in the household. It's not about citizenship. It's not an issue. The United States Supreme Court ruled that. No one's going to ask you about your bank accounts or anything else. But we do need to get everyone counted. Otherwise, we're going to get shortchanged both for federal money and obviously political representation.
That is Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So we're going to dive further into this now, both the president's tweet from today and the increasing political, what do you want to call it, tension, striving, back and forth, push and pull about mail-in voting this year during a presidential election and during a pandemic. Here is Governor Charlie Baker speaking at a press conference earlier today.
We've had elections in the midst of world wars. We've had an election in the midst of a civil war. We've had elections in many times in this country during terrible, awful circumstances. But elections need to happen, and there's no reason why this one can't happen.
And we want to open the phones to you. What's your reaction to the president's tweet, to the scale of mail-in voting this year, to the idea that an election needs to be postponed in order to make sure that it's secure versus the idea that the reliability of the election is a safety issue in and of itself? Let us know what you're thinking. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can tweet us at Radio Boston as well. We have two great guests to have this conversation with us. First with us is David Gergen. He was an advisor to four U.S. presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He's also the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, where he is still on faculty. David Gergen, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We are also joined by Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors, and deputy CEO and general counsel for the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. Michael Curry, welcome back to you, too.
Glad to be back on.
So let me actually start by just asking your reactions to what we just heard from Secretary of State Galvin. Are you both as confident as he is that we are scaled up and can do this type of mail-in voting here in the Commonwealth and that it's going to go off well and safely? David Gergen, I'll start with you.
Well, I don't think we have perfect confidence, but I think we can have a lot of hope. Massachusetts had been well organized, better organized than most states in dealing with this pandemic. We've obviously had our problems, but that was a much more complicated situation than the voting. And I think we've had enough experience now and seen how dangerous it can be if voters do believe that the voting is fraudulent. It's really, really important that it be well conducted. I thought we just heard a conversation that seemed quite reasonable about what Massachusetts was doing, quite detailed and very thoughtful. And I do think it's really going to be important to expand the number of days that people can vote in person. It's not just a question of mail-in ballots, but expanding the days you can go in person, especially during this pandemic. People are going to want to make sure that they're not going to stand in a long line for 2 or 3 hours.
And Michael Curry, we've had you on the show talking about mail-in voting before. What was your reaction to what the secretary said, and how are you feeling about the Commonwealth and the nation's readiness for more early voting, on mail-in voting, et cetera, during this pandemic?
Yeah, you know, as I was listening to the secretary, I couldn't help but think about William Watkins, who's one of the leaders over at the Urban League, and he had a comment he made recently. He said it took a pandemic to give us 2020 vision, since we're quarantined and stuck at home. And I think the reality is we're embracing all of these opportunities to expand the franchise, and whether that's same-day voting, using technology in a smarter, better way, mail-in voting because of the pandemic, it makes sense. I have complete trust in Secretary Galvin and his team that they'll implement this well. We know that there's very little voter fraud, and that was really a distraction under the Trump administration. So why don't we just move forward? There is no reason to delay an election. We're hearing it from both sides of the aisle. And I think the secretary gave us pretty solid confidence that we can make this happen.
Well, we certainly have calls. So let's go to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's start with Mary Beth in Melrose. Mary Beth, go ahead.
Yeah, I am a registered voter, and I live in a household with four other registered voters, myself, my husband, and my three sons. And we only received three vote-by-mail applications for three of us. And I know how to get them, so I mean, I don't have a problem with it, but it does kind of make me worry about the system if all five of us did not get the vote-by-mail applications.
Thanks for that, Mary Beth. And David Gergen, I'll turn back to you. Just a minute ago, you talked about how important it was that people perceive the election and the mail-in voting. So when you hear Mary Beth, that's worrisome, yeah?
It is, but and I'm really glad Mary Beth called in, because it does put people on alert that we may have some issues. We need to deal with it. But the good thing is, you know, we're some 97 days away now before the election. There is time to cure these problems as long as we bring them to the fore. So I think you having this, you know, having these kind of conversations on WBUR is terrific, because it gets everybody into, okay, we're all going to do this, we all need to vote, and let's get these things straight so Mary Beth gets all five of her ballots and gets them in ample time, but she doesn't feel anxious about it.
Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. We have Michael on the line from Saugus. Michael, go ahead.
The only problem I see with the mail-in voting is, how do you guarantee the ballots are cast in secret and the voters aren't bribed or intimidated? The secret ballot's a cornerstone of democracy.
It's a great question, Michael, and I'm going to add another voice. I've got Ashley from Roxbury. Ashley, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I was just curious. So I live in Roxbury, and I've been asked by a lot of people where I live in an elderly disabled building, the ballot goes into the mailbox, and then what? How do you know that the ballot, you know, that your ballot isn't going to be, you know, taken out? I mean, that sounds stupid, mm-hmm. but where does it go?
No, I think it's a good question, Ashley. Yeah, and I think it follows on the heels of Michael in Saugus, too. So let's turn to Michael Curry on that. These are real questions about sort of chain of custody of the ballots, Michael Curry, and how we feel confident that chain of custody respects what our democratic principles around voting are.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is not new to voting. We've always had to solve for challenges, right? The hanging chads, and you can go down the history of this country with voting. I've worked the polls and knew that our precincting process, resulted in large numbers of people waiting in line where you can go just a few blocks down the road, and it was a small line, right? So we've had to solve for challenges in our voting process throughout all of our lifetimes. I think this is no different. We'll make sure the Secretary Galvin and the secretaries across the country, they are charged with making sure that we protect the privacy of the voter, that we protect the chain of custody, as you said, to make sure that those ballots get to the proper location and they're counted. It's all great questions. I think Michael's question and the question that followed that are great questions. The secretary and his team have ample time to work to solve that. And then it won't be perfect. There'll still be some errors along the way, but we'll still have an election with legitimacy and some assurance that it's being held and votes are being counted.
Yeah.
So David Gergen, let's pick up on that legitimacy word that Michael just used. Yeah. And I want to pivot to the president's tweet, which seems to have been at least designed to call into question the legitimacy of the election, which he has done in advance a number of times already, but also just sort of lays out this bombshell of postponing the election. We have been in such unprecedented times. I feel like I'm constantly asking people who come on air, how bad is this? And I got to ask you on this one, how bad is it to have a president of the United States float the idea of delaying a presidential election?
Well, it reflects very badly on him. This is a perfectly awful proposal on his part, on President Trump's part. It is designed not only to divert attention at a time 150,000 Americans have died from COVID and that our economy is going down. It went down in the second quarter more rapidly than any time in, 70 years of measuring such things. It is designed to divert our attention, as Michael said earlier. But you know what was encouraging about today was the way that when he put this trial balloon up, it got knocked out of the sky in about 10 seconds. By people on both sides of the aisle, including McConnell from Kentucky, a lot of Republicans. I can't find a single Republican who's come out in favor of what the president said today. He's been unanimously rejected by his party as well as by the Democrats. So that's good news that the country may finally, and the Republican Party may finally be willing to break with Trump on some things that are perfectly obvious to most Americans. That's encouraging. I do want to add, if I might, just one little postscript to this question of this early voting, and that is I have a lot of confidence, and I think Michael was absolutely right about the Secretary of State and the Massachusetts way of doing this, but we should not forget that there are a lot of states, especially southern states, I'm from the South, where suppression of voting remains a serious issue. Kentucky, just in the past few days, has done some things that the Democrats really feel are unfair on the suppression point.
So, Michael Curry, let you jump in and build on that.
Yeah, I totally agree with David. David's been doing this work a long time. He's seen all the games that can be played. I always tell people when it comes to the electoral process, it's chess, not checkers. And the voter suppression efforts is really people organized to play chess when too many of us are still playing checkers. And the reality is we got to still check those secretaries and those systems to make sure that they are not suppressing the vote. And I think that, I've talked to advocates across the country as a national board member. We have a process in place for voter protection. We are challenging in the courtrooms and in city halls and in legislatures the process to make sure that every vote counts. I feel confident that this election will be like every other election with some hiccups, but we should be voting. I think about Donald Trump and his challenge of delaying the election. I think about my sports analogies. He's looking up at the score. It's the first quarter. He's seeing the polls. He's seeing the economic numbers, GDP down, dramatically unemployment numbers. And he's already starting to think about the fourth quarter and how he can change the outcome and essentially creating a fifth quarter. Leader McCarthy and others are telling him no. And I hope, David, that we don't see the flip that we often see on the Republican side, whereas they get closer to the fourth quarter. I would be concerned that some of them might be singing in the same tune.
I think it's a very legitimate concern.
Let's go to the phones here. 800-423-8255. We've got Sandy on the line from the Back Bay. Sandy, go ahead.
Hi there. Yes, I just wanted to make three quick points. One is clearly Trump is afraid and he knows he's losing, and this is his way of discrediting the upcoming election. Two, if he had any interest in making sure they were secure elections, he had 4 years to do so, and he didn't. And three, he did the exact same thing 4 years ago, except for he won. And then when he won, suddenly there was no fraudulent activity, even though it was proven that the Russians did try to hack our election. So it just he's vulnerable and he's scared and he's showing it, and it's outrageous, absolutely outrageous. That's all I had.
Well, Sandy, I appreciate your call. There's a lot there. I'm going to turn it to David Gergen. I just want to point out that there are still people on both sides of the idea of whether the Russians hacked the election in the way that you're talking about. I just got to be fair on that. But I am going to turn it to David Gergen now to react to the things Sandy said.
Well, I think Sandy was right on many of these points. Nobody can say that the Russians fully tilted this election because we just don't have the evidence to support that. But we do know that the Russians wanted to disrupt. We do know that the Russians have had evil instincts toward us, malevolent instincts toward us for several years now, and that we're not taking them seriously. I mean, even now, this issue about the Russians giving money for putting bounties on the heads of American soldiers in places like Afghanistan. You know, the president has had several conversations with Putin since all this came up, and he has not once raised this issue with him. So I do think we have legitimate right to be concerned about whether the Russians are going to try to tamper with this election. We need to go into this election. Whether you're for Biden or not for Biden, we need to go into this election vigilant to guard against the kind of organized efforts to steal it from us one way or another. And I do think those concerns are legitimate, especially among people of color, that their votes are not going to be taken. That somehow they're going to get screwed again. I think we all ought to be on the side of let's do this fairly and let the chips fall where they may.
There's another thread there that I want to pick up, and I'll turn to you, Michael Curry, on this from Sandy's call, which is kind of the pay no attention to the man behind the curtain aspect of this. We did have just a stunning announcement today that GDP on a national, rolling out the what the national average would be, is on track to drop more than a third, which is just unprecedented. And we do know that this tweet came out pretty close in time to when that news came out. What about Sandy's point that this is a distraction?
Yeah, I think he's a master of distraction. I would argue that if you got many Republicans in the room, they would tell you that as well. He deflects, and he does it very well, quite frankly. I think he gets the rest of us on these news segments trying to diagnose and understand what he said and what he meant, when in fact is very intentional, just to keep us sort of bound up in confusion and frustration. He knows that the economy is not great. Now, understandably, the economy is not great because we shut down and quarantined and stayed at home, and businesses are failing and people are unemployed and people are in threat of losing their home, disparately communities of color. Like, we see businesses of color failing. We see black families, brown families at risk of losing their homes as they're losing their jobs. So I think the reality is I wish he had woke up this morning and decided to tweet about Congressman Lewis. I wish he had decided to tweet about that and not tweet about delaying elections. He is a horrible compass for this country as to what is appropriate decorum, what is respectful behavior in the White House. And we got to remember that. We have to take note of that. As David knows, presidents matter. What they say and what they do matter. And he's disappointing in that regard.
David, I heard you sort of react to Michael there. Let me turn it to you.
Listen, I think we've passed the point where the president can do. He's done a lot of damage to the presidency, to the office of the presidency. He's done enormous damage to the respect in which we've been held by the world. People have looked to us for centuries, or sort of, that fabulous city on a hill that we talk about a lot. We're no longer a city on a hill, and we've lost a lot of the kind of attractiveness, the kind of soft power, if you would, that Joe Nye talks about. Because of the way we have handled this virus, because of the way we've handled the reopening, because of the way that we have, we've got this sort of clownish approach to the presidency and the Oval Office. And there's so many ways in which we're paying a huge price. But we should be judged as a people by what we do in November. Let's see how the votes come out, and that'll give us a much better sense of who are we as Americans. Have we lost our way in some fashion, or are we going to reassert ourselves as a strong citizenry who really care about the decency and the sort of openness and promotion of racial justice in this country? I think we have a chance to write a new judgment into the history books in this election.
Amen.
All right.
Amen.
Good point. I think I'm going to end it there with the amen. The amen came from Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, member of the National NAACP Board, deputy CEO and general counsel for the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. Michael, thanks.
Thank you.
And David Gergen, an advisor to four presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, Clinton, also the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. David, thanks so much for joining us
again. Thank you, and thank you, Michael. It's good to be with you both.
He was willing to fight in the struggle, and he was willing to get in the trouble.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Just a couple of hours ago, the nation said its final farewell to the late John Lewis. The music you're hearing is a special song written for Lewis by B.B. Winan and sung by B.B. and his brother Marvin called Good Trouble, which closed out the funeral service held at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta earlier today. Considered by many to have been the conscience of the Congress and a lion in the fight for civil rights, a host of national speakers, including three former U.S. presidents, paid tribute during the ceremony. In his eulogy, President Obama said that Lewis, as much as anyone in our history, helped the nation stride towards its highest ideals.
And someday when we do finish that long journey towards freedom, when we do form a more perfect union, whether it's years from now or decades or even if it takes another two centuries, John Lewis will be a founding father of that fuller, fairer, better America.
Since Lewis's passing, we have talked here on Radio Boston about his place in history, the importance of the work he did, and how that work will be carried on by the next generation of young leaders. But today, for this final farewell, we focus on John Lewis, the man. We spoke with Shirley Small Rougeau and her son Vincent Rougeau, whose family life was intertwined with Lewis's in the pursuit of social justice. Shirley is now retired and living in Weston, Massachusetts, and Vincent is the dean of the Boston College Law School. And I started by asking Shirley how she first met John.
I was living in Miami, and two other friends of mine who worked for SNCC and CORE came to Miami to attend a voter registration conference teaching us how to do these voter registration drives. And John was among them, with David Dennis and Henry Thomas, better known as Hank. And I just, you know, met him briefly at that meeting. But because I was involved with CORE, with Vincent's father, I, you know, communicated back and forth, or we were in touch with those who were working in Mississippi and Alabama.
And when you say CORE, do you mean the Congress of Racial Equity?
Of Racial Equality, yes.
What was your first impression when you met him?
I was blown away because he was so serious among those other young men and women who were SNCC people. And I think the group of CORE volunteers and workers were slightly older, as I am 1 year older than John. So, but they were all kind of happy-go-lucky, very serious about their work, but John was thoughtful, incisive about whatever he was doing, and almost always ended up charging the group with doing something. Let's not just sit around shooting the bobo, as we would call it. Let's do something. And, you know, when we were together in Atlanta or wherever, he said, let's go downtown and march on Riches or something. Let's do something.
Vince, were you a young person when you met him? I understand you babysat for his son at one point. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I guess I probably met him, you know, as a preschool-aged child when my parents were living in Atlanta. But I don't remember that. I probably remember meeting him for the first time when we moved to Washington, D.C., or the Washington, D.C. area. And so that would have been in the, you know, mid to late 70s. 75 is when we moved there. So I probably met him right around that time. And yeah, I was started babysitting for his son one summer shortly after that. It was probably, I don't know, I was probably like in ninth grade, mom, or something like that.
Yes, yes.
Shirley, right. When I was younger, we used to play a game sometimes that was, if you could go back in history at any point and, you know, meet a person or have lunch with a person, who would it be? And I was thinking about that today, and I was wondering, he's a legend and was understood as a legend in his lifetime. But when you met him and in those early days, did you have a sense of him being legendary?
Well, not in a sense of his being legendary, but I just knew upon meeting him at first and knowing his history of, you know, having had been involved in the sit-ins that when he was a student, I was a student as well. And I just knew he was going to be a great leader of his peers. I didn't know, and as you've probably heard, he was not a great speaker. You know, he had a lisp and he had problems pronouncing certain words, but whatever he said even then was so powerful. He always emoted. He always said something very significant.
You know, these were all really highly educated, polished people, you know, with master's degrees and PhDs, a lot of them over time. So, you know, I think they were very hard on themselves in terms of the standards that they imposed on one another. So I think what Mom just described is a great example of that. It's not that he wasn't a great speaker. It was just that they had very high expectations of each other, and they would quickly identify ways that people should improve, and, you know, or areas where they weren't at their best in terms of this or that thing. But I think what Mom said was right. I mean, his emotional power was clear to everybody, despite whatever, you know, sort of polish he might have lacked from time to time.
Vince, what did it mean for you to grow up in that environment and around such luminaries with such exacting standards and strong vision for the future?
Well, you know, obviously when I was a child, I probably didn't realize just what a gift I was being given to be around these people all the time. You know, it's sort of like, in some senses, you know, civil rights was the family business and you don't always appreciate the things that you're, you know, surrounded by. And sometimes it seemed like a lot, you know, maybe not, I wouldn't say a burden, but, you know, expectations were high and our parents had done extraordinary things. And continue to do extraordinary things. Just, you know, they were often trailblazers, you know, first at so many things, you know, or we'd be the first, you know, Black family in a suburban neighborhood. I mean, we were always trailblazing, and sometimes it was exhausting. But being around all of these folks and listening to them over time, particularly as I got older, I became very much aware of the fact that I was in the presence of something very, very special, and to be able to learn from these people and to see how they, you know, moved the nation through their perseverance and their ability to focus on a goal and to hold themselves, as we said, to very high standards and to press forward, became something that, you know, I started to model my own life on over time.
You lost a friend, Shirley. I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
How have you been feeling?
I have been both devastated emotionally, but so proud, because I believe that he was given the honor that he deserved, and he would be proud to know. Now, he was not one who looked for adulation, or he was just plain John, and he didn't ever get concerned about himself. It was always about, well, what are you doing, and where's this one? He'd always ask me about the children and things like that. But I think that I feel so proud that people have come from all over the country and even over the world to pay tribute to John. And I just, you know, we're all going to miss him. But I think that I have a special, special place that is just empty now. It's empty, and I know it will be fulfilled at some point. It'll fill. But right now, I just feel empty.
When I've lost somebody I really care about, I think back to the feelings in those days and weeks after, and there's usually both some anger and some real gratitude. Is there anything you're angry about now in the wake of John Lewis's death? And is there anything you're particularly grateful for?
Well, I'm grateful that John Lewis lived, and I'm grateful that he lived the life that he did. I'm extremely grateful that he left such a legacy for the young people and those who are even coming behind the young people who are in the streets of today. And I'm very angry about those persons who have been totally dishonest about, you know, their honoring and their raising John Lewis's name to higher heights, but yet are unwilling to do those things that they know would be the right thing to do. That angers me very much. But someone said to me, a friend, oh, I understand why John Lewis is so angry, but Vince knows John was not angry. Passionate, yes, but angry, no, he was not angry. So I am trying to teach myself to mitigate this anger and rage that I feel because people are not being honest about their feelings in terms of what John Lewis stood for.
And what would your message to young people now be, Shirley?
My message would be the same as John's. First of all, to show love most of all, but in all you do, if you see something, say something. Stand up and do something. Most of all, please vote, 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 because that's what John spent most of his life working toward, the ability for all people to vote. And that I want to add as well. John was not just about any particular race of people, people of color, black people. John loved all people, and he wanted all people to be able to live in this society with the rights and responsibilities that we all have.
That was Shirley Small Rougeau, a close friend of John Lewis, now retired and living in Weston, Massachusetts, and her son, Vincent Rougeau, the dean of Boston College Law School. Shortly before his passing, John Lewis wrote an essay that he asked the New York Times to publish on the day of his funeral. You can find a link to that essay on our website, radioboston.org. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston. And we're going to go out today with a little more music from Congressman Lewis's funeral service. This is Jennifer Holliday singing Take My Hand, Precious Lord.